Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Lisa, good afternoon, Lisa.
Hi, Joe, how are you?
Good. Well, how are you? This happened on two Fridays ago, Friday, June the 6th. It was late at night. What happened?
That's right, Joe. So, look, I just wanted to start with what I'm saying. I'm not a person to usually make a complaint against anything, but I just felt it was really important that I make Dublin Bus and TFI aware of a very distressing situation that I faced on the 77A bus on Friday, the June 6th, and it was around 12:30.
And the 77A bus goes from Dublin City Centre or...
Yeah, I'm not sure of its origin, but I got on the bus at Dame Street and it goes to City West through Tallaght and Kilnarden.
And that's its terminus.
Yeah, okay. So the terminus is City West, yeah.
Okay.
So the bus route passes by my estate in Kilnarden and Tallaght very frequently on its way to City West. And I caught the last bus home around 11:30. I was with my sister. We were out with a couple of friends. We had dinner. We went to see a play. So my sister and I got the last bus home and we were sitting upstairs for the whole journey. But then when we reached the square, she got off to go home to her own apartment and I moved downstairs. But just then, as we pulled our way from the square stop, the bus driver just randomly shouts out his little window, the bus is not going through Kilnarden. It's just going straight to City West. Now, at this point, my heart completely sank because when I heard this, I was like, oh, well, I need to get to Kilnarden. So I went up to the bus driver and I asked him, why are we not going to Kilnarden? So he says, there's antisocial behaviour there. Bus is not going through. I said, okay, but I live there and I need to get dropped off at the, at the stop outside my estate. And again, he stated very clearly, nope, the bus is not going there. I asked him, well, how do you know there's antisocial behaviour happening? And he told me he got a call about it. So then he's very matter-of-fact and I just said, okay, well, so now I made the point to him that because of this last-minute decision, I, a woman completely alone and defenceless, now have to walk in the dark for 25 minutes to get to my home through an area where the bus is, where a bus is afraid to go. He simply said, yep, no matter what, he was not going through Kilnarden. He had an instruction to follow. Now, I was completely shocked and thrown by this. And I felt I had, you know, it was only two stops to go to get off the bus for where I felt, okay, this is the last stop I need to get off now is Lessington Road, or I'd end up in City West because he was not taking the route through Kilnarden. So look, I kept my cool and I stepped off the bus in Lessington stop. And I literally had one thought in the moment. I was like, right, get home, quick, get home now. Unfortunately, my partner was working a late night shift, so he wasn't at home to call, but look, this is completely beside the point. So I literally started power walking, and at first I was on the left side, but look, it's so dark, so full of trees, railings, I quickly crossed the road. So at least then I would be beside houses, under streetlights. And then even as I crossed the road, I spotted a person in a hood walking from where I had just come from, which just, you know, it just sparks fear in you and you start to panic a little bit more. So then I actually phoned my sister so that I would have her on the phone so she would know exactly where I was and what I was doing. Just God forbid something happened. Now, look, I was constantly scanning up and down the road because as we all know, and you know very well, it's a very unfortunate reality that people are experiencing all sorts of unprovoked attacks on busy streets, in broad daylight, never mind in a dark, quiet suburban area, you know, in the dead of night. You just, you have to have your wits about you. But look, very luckily for me, there was no antisocial behaviour going on around the area. Yet at the same time, it was so eerily quiet that I was extremely nervous as I was walking past open park spaces, empty playgrounds, shuttered shops. So I just kept walking as quickly as I could because I was like, I'm not safe until I lock my front door behind me. Now, I was expecting to come across a group of people being antisocial because after all, that's what the bus driver said. The bus isn't going there. There's antisocial behaviour happening. So, like, Joe, this actually, like, begs the question, did the bus driver get a call? And if so, it's just, how is it acceptable to cut out a large portion of a route last minute, late at night, knowing that a lone female passenger has to get home there safely? I mean, by cutting out this entire route, he missed five or six stops. which is a 25 to 35 minute walk for anyone who may have needed to get off in
after,
that area.
After midnight.
After midnight.
Lisa, was there any indication when you got on the bus that it was not going to go to Killinarden? Okay. Was there any indication while you were on the bus that you weren't going to go to Killinarden until you
I was upstairs until I got to the square, but there was no indication until I moved downstairs. And I mean, if my sister hadn't gotten off at the square, I may have still been upstairs and never heard anything. Yeah. So only for the fact I was downstairs standing close to the driver as he shouted out the window, "This bus isn't going to Killinarden." Nobody else spoke up. Nobody else seemed to have an issue with it. Like,
just
nobody
so
else seemed to
out.
Need to get
yeah.
off there. But I only found out at the last minute. And I mean, it's just not acceptable to call that out, you know, 2 minutes before the stop is about to come up, you know. And also, I actually want to state that this is not the first time that this has happened to me.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, the first,
A number of points. One, I know the bus journeys, and if you get off three stops before your home, the chances of getting a taxi are slim, because it's a very,
very
short,
slim.
If not impossible.
Exactly.
Two, the bus itself is a pretty formidable vehicle in terms of safety. I'm not advocating that anyone have a bounce off a bus. But like a bus is a much more safer environment for you than an overcoat walking.
Exactly, exactly. And this is what I stated in my email to them. I said, look, a bus is a huge chunk of metal moving quickly along the road. And I do understand. I do understand that there have been many antisocial incidents on buses.
Yeah.
Bus drivers have had to face a lot of issues and a lot of unnecessary harassment, of course, and that is completely unacceptable. But if there is an issue happening outside the bus has the power to keep moving. Don't stop. Keep going until you reach a safe spot and that a passenger can get off safely. But do not completely cut out an entire route on the off chance that one of the stops can't be
and
stopped.
The door, and in every modern bus since 1980, the doors are locked. The doors are closed automatically.
Exactly.
And they can only be opened from the inside except in an emergency way, emergency personnel. Now, did the bus driver say, well, listen, I'll ring the guards and if they come up and go with me, I'll bring you through?
No. He had his instruction. He wasn't going into Killinarden, making my own way home. Now, I'm in my 30s. I can walk fast. I was wearing runners. But Joe, what if it was an older person, with mobility issues, a young person in high heels who's had a few more drinks, or your phone battery's dead, no way of calling for a lift, you don't even know the area that well. You know, the big bus is afraid to go down that area, but we alone, completely defenceless, have to walk home through it.
And
anyway,
it's a public service that you pay. You paid for, and you pay for in a number of ways, both through taxes and through fares. And through subsidies. Blake Boland is in the press office of Dublin Bus. Blake, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Why did this happen?
Yeah, this is a terrible situation. It's one that we really regret. And, you know, our customers and our drivers should not have to go through these kind of incidents. We're seeing a really stark rise in antisocial behaviour the last number of years. And it's having a serious knock-on effect to our passengers, to our customers and our drivers as well. And in incidents like this, we have to suspend services at times. And it really does cause knock-on effects and leads to situations like this. It's something that we're trying to get ahead of.
Have you looked into this particular episode? The timings and what was going on and why it wasn't why it wasn't announced earlier? Was there any other options considered? What was the prompt for this disruption and Lisa having to walk 25 minutes after midnight on her own as the bus disappeared in the distance up to City West and missed five stops?
The decision was made at 10:15 to suspend services for the rest of the evening until resumption the next day. So that would have actually been the second time that day that there was a suspension on that route. So we do have a protocol in place to keep our drivers and our customers safe. So earlier on that day, there was an incident of antisocial behaviour, which I believe was stone throwing at the bus. Now, at that stage, once that was communicated back to central control, the decision was made to suspend services.
So who makes that decision?
So that comes back to central control. Now, the protocol has been made in conjunction with An Garda Síochána, trade unions, local community groups, Dublin Bus Management Operations. But at the time, that would come back to Dublin Bus. Now, our chief inspector went out on site, surveyed it, deemed that it was then safe, and services did resume. But unfortunately, there was another incident later on that evening. And then at that stage, the decision was made to suspend those services. So that those few stops, and it's in and around 7, 8, 9 stops that come off that main road there. So it would have bypassed that estate and instead picked up on the normal route about 600 metres further down the line. And I just want to say that these decisions are not made lightly. This is not something that we want to do. We want to serve every single stop that we can, every person.
But it was made at 10:15. Lisa got on the bus at 11:30 in Dame Street.
Yeah, so the route does, it begins back in Ringsend, and there's, you know, give or take 40, 50, 60 stops on the way out to the terminus. And we do have, we have a process in place then when decisions like this are made. So we will feed information back to the RTPI screens. So it should come up on the screens that services are suspended in a certain area. Now, as you know, not every one of these stops have those screens there. But there's also further to that it will go up on the website, and we do put it up on social media as well. And another part of that is that the drivers are told about this. So this driver was obviously communicated that we would not be serving those stops for a certain period of time. And they should be communicating that to their staff. And I do believe that they are very good at this. And they should be communicating to the staff that they are not serving a certain area.
I think they should communicate to the passengers. People getting on the bus. Is the driver, given that the driver is the main interaction when you're getting on a bus, not a bus stop and not the website or Twitter or whatever, but is the driver instructed to advise oncoming passengers, we are not going through Killinarden?
So that's where the communication comes in, and they are that.
Are they obliged to tell the customer, given that they are the main interface?
They have to communicate that with the customers.
And if they don't?
But that's a matter that we need to investigate then.
And what happens
if communication is extremely important.
Okay.
And we need to get that information across.
And what happens if you discover, no, the driver didn't?
Well, that will be up to the depot to speak to the driver to make an interview to investigate what happened. Now, That is, if we do get a complaint on that, we can investigate that and look into it. But it's important here just to remember that we have the policies in place, we have the structures and the processes in place, and we want to make sure that we're following those, because communication is absolutely key here.
But it didn't happen.
When
you talk about the safety of your driver, no one on the wide earthly world would disagree with that, and the safety of your passengers. What you mean is the safety of your passengers when they are on the bus. But there was no concern for the safety of this woman when she got off the bus, when the five stops were missed. And she had to make this 25-minute walk in the dark on her own.
We are not happy about this, Joe. Like, the level of antisocial behaviour that we're experiencing on our services has increased. We're trying to get ahead of this. We're trying to do as much as we can, and that's putting an emergency, you know, having that ability for the driver to speak, you know, press an emergency button, speak to central control, get that information fed back to An Garda Síochána. We have trained teams of security personnel that board buses around our city. We're doing just to go back to my, we want to do is to serve every single
bus. Of course,
bus
I know that, but I'm
community. But that's this, what we're working
this
towards.
This is a pretty serious situation, I think. That a woman.
I fully agree with you.
Okay, Lisa, what do you want to say to the spokesperson for Dublin Bus, Blake Boland?
Look, I completely understand that there has been antisocial behaviour and all of that, and none of that is acceptable against any bus driver, 100%. But you're saying that, yeah, this is all notified on the bus driver has to communicate it to the passengers. And unfortunately, in this incident, it was not communicated to me when I got on the bus at Dame Street. Like, that bus journey is quite long. It's half an hour, 40 minutes to Tallaght. So there was plenty, ample time for him to let me know, this bus isn't going to Killinarden. Telling me at the square bus stop that this is not going to Killinarden, which is only two stops away, isn't acceptable. So the communication wasn't there at that time.
Do you accept that, Blake?
we absolutely need to look into that because...
No, but you have had an email from Lisa, in fairness, before today's interaction.
Yes, I did email them before, yes.
And when did that email go in?
The Saturday morning after, on June 7th.
So two weeks ago.
Yes.
What have you discovered since, Blake, about this episode?
So if you want to get Lisa to leave the details of that with your producers, I can follow up on that.
No, Lisa's speaking English to us and she's very clear what she's saying. And she wrote an email in English, which is extraordinarily clear. And this is 2 weeks ago. And you're saying, will you give me the details?
So
I did get a response from them.
Okay.
So I did get a response from them shortly afterwards, like multiple responses from different people. But in the long and short of it all, it was just apologies and excuses as to why sometimes bus routes don't go down the way that they need to go, such as technical issues, mechanical failures, traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, that's all well and good. That's fine. I understand those situations, but none of those situations applied to my case at that moment in time.
And given, the other thing as well, Blake, given, and I'm a frequent user of Dublin Bus, and I have nothing but admiration, and I understand the importance of it. You say the Killinard, this estate, is it's not unusual for bus routes to be suspended. It actually happened earlier that day. Is there any possibility of even giving the bus driver a little sign that he could put on the window?
That's all I'm looking for from Dublin Bus, is just for much more ample notification when you get on the bus. And like I said before, this isn't even the first time it's happened to me. This is the second time. But only the last time, my boyfriend was with me, so we walked together home alone. And I was annoyed at that time, but at least he was with me. But then when it happened a second time, I was just completely appalled. And so both times, the driver shouted out the window just past the square.
But Joe, in this instance, if it wasn't communicated to Lisa, which seems to be the case, that's a straight-up apology if that didn't happen. What we're endeavouring here to do is to communicate that, and I've laid out what we're trying to do there, and it looks like it hasn't happened in this case. And on the phone now, all I can do is apologise. Mm-hmm. Like this is not what we don't want this to happen to a single time. We don't want this to happen in the first place.
Who has the final say in pulling a bus service? It's the unions, isn't it?
So decisions like this will be made at central control by Dublin Bus Management, but it's important to say as well that it's not a decision that's made lightly or in isolation.
We do speak with
the unions, with representatives from the local area, with An Garda Síochána Síochána, with their staff, and that's how we've come up with this process. And because it's really important to take everybody's opinion into account here. This is like where we are talking about people's safety, not, you know, our drivers, our passengers, what happens before when they get off the bus. So you need to consult with everybody on this.
But would it be fair to say, and I'm sure there's drivers like every Dublin bus driver, male, female, and are diligent and vigilant, but would it not be fair to say that Lisa walking that 25 minutes in the darkness after midnight 2 weeks ago, that she was in a much less safer position than a bus driver in a bus, in a cabin in the bus that's locked, rightly so, that has some protection, and won't withstand everything. Would it be fair to say that Lisa was in a much less safer position than the bus driver?
So, like, this Joe comes back to, like, this is an issue at a societal level. Really.
I know that.
So what we're, you know, our responsibility here is to keep our drivers and our passengers as safe as possible. And the decisions have been made, as I've mentioned already, working through An Garda Síochána to suspend services in a certain area.
Is there any protocol where you say,
did anyone
look at any options here? For example, if it is late at night, and given the issues that arise, given that it was a woman, and we know women walking on their own, it's a much different experience. So it's not always safe for a man either, but it's a much different experience. Much more like, is there any options? Like, is the driver told, listen, if it is after midnight, if it is very dark, please ring the Garda, please ring control. Well, you don't have to ring control. You press a button to talk to control. And control will get on to Garda control and see, can they send up a van or a car or whatever to escort the bus through Killinarden? So that the passenger, who was your priority, the staff and passengers, your passenger who was your priority, who paid to get to a certain place, is not dropped off 25 minutes from that place. But I'm saying, are the drivers told, listen, try this before you let that passenger off the bus. Say to them, I'm going to ring control. I'm going to ask control, can they get a police car up here, a Garda car up here to come with us? Is that an option?
We would be open to every suggestion, and I think this is going to take brainstorming and people coming up with ideas across the whole of society. So between An Garda Síochána, ourselves, operations, drivers, local community groups, we're open to any ideas to keep people safe. And you know, you've mentioned An Garda Síochána there, and like, one thing that we're trying to get to is we've put our Safer Journey team on buses, mm-hmm. to try to prevent and to kind of isolate and hone in incidents like this, so we can prevent them, not just respond to them once they happen, so things like this don't happen to Lisa. And that's why we're actively lobbying as well for the establishment of a transport police.
You know, yeah, but in the meantime, that's when then everyone is lobbying, yeah, for that. And I don't know what difference transport. We have a guard, we have a very big guard force, and it's getting bigger. Why can't they be our transport police? They have all the powers. We don't need another commissioner. We don't need another HR. We don't need another administration. We need more boots on the ground, so to speak, literally. I don't think it's helpful saying, or meaningful saying to Lisa, oh, we are lobbying for transport police.
No. Look, what we've given to Lisa right here on the phone, I've said it, is that apology that we haven't communicated, mm-hmm. to Lisa, it seems. You know, I've laid out what we're endeavouring to do for every passenger that we haven't communicated.
Well, you haven't communicated. No. You haven't communicated. You haven't communicated it to your bus driver. Lisa wasn't driving the bus. Lisa didn't stop the bus and say, I'm going straight to City West, good luck. It was your driver. And you say there is a protocol, and that protocol, and you've known of this complaint for 2 weeks, and Lisa has said she's got numerous responses. But I want to know, in that 2 weeks, what's been done about this really serious situation where this woman was left after midnight in an area where the Dublin bus had decided it wasn't safe for a 4-ton vehicle to go through. But it was so, therefore, the option taken was to let the passenger off the bus, a young woman wearing an overcoat as protection. And I know the mobile phone is so important to women. I know your set of keys, Lisa, is so important to you as well. Shouldn't have to be.
Yeah.
But that decision was made, Blake, that Lisa's safety was less important than the safety of a 3-ton bus.
Joe, this comes back to, we don't want this to happen. We've apologised there to Lisa for that communication. Like, we do not want stones been thrown at our bus,
well, no,
having
of course,
to withdraw
nobody
services.
Does. Nobody
we,
does.
We don't want what our drivers have to go through. They are doing an extremely difficult job.
I know, and they do a great job in the main. They do.
Yeah, and we have collaborated with the trade unions on Garda Síochána community groups to come up with a solution to when antisocial behaviour have.
When,
this is one of the, and this when, is not
do,
what we want
when
to
do. You,
Lisa
when do you,
should not have to go
okay.
through this.
When did you interview the bus driver involved?
So we don't discuss the investigation like that on air. So I would encourage just to get those details so that I can chase up that
investigation. They're all there.
But
she hasn't.
We're not going to discuss
issue a face. The date is there. The time is there. The location is there. This is an email sent 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, but I'm not going to discuss that investigation on air.
Is there an investigation underway?
As I've just said, this won't be discussed on air. Now, Lisa has sent in a complaint. And I'm glad that she's done that, because we want to know if our processes aren't being followed.
Okay. Lisa, by the way, where you said you got a number of replies, because nobody understands. I don't, of course people do, but nobody really understands who runs Dublin Bus anymore. Is it TFI? Is it Dublin Bus? Is it Bus Éireann? You see so
it's
many
TFI
logos.
That I got the response from.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And what did they say, Transport for Ireland? What did they say?
So they started off just saying, we're very sorry to hear about the incident letter. A case has been created for your incident, you reported. It'll be forwarded to the relevant department so they may investigate, and we'll respond in 5 to 7 working days. Now, these emails did come in promptly, fairness. Yeah. Then they said, we passed it on to Dublin Bus. Sorry, we got a response from Dublin Bus regarding your concern. We appreciate your patience in this matter. Please rest assured that we take your concern seriously. Therefore, we've passed this on to the relevant department. And then they said again, we apologise for any inconvenience this may have caused and thank you for taking the time to bring this to our attention. Then the next one said, I refer to your email regarding the reliability of the service on Route 77A. Every reasonable endeavour is made by Dublin Bus to ensure the operation of its buses according to schedule. Unfortunately, from time to time, the reliability of our services may be disrupted due to breakdowns, maintenance issues, traffic conditions or incidents. We understand the inconvenience this causes our customers and we ask that you please accept our apologies on this occasion. In relation on the comments, we will pass them on to the relevant department to make them aware. On behalf of Dublin Bus, thank you for bringing this matter to our attention. On behalf of Transport of Ireland, I hope you'll accept our apologies for any inconvenience or discomfort caused to you. Now, look, I received apologies through emails. I accept your apology on air. Thank you very much. Look, my only goal here is just to make Dublin Bus aware of this situation and that going forward, there has to be better communication from the outset of a journey. Even if that means it's up on the screen, perfect. The bus driver even mentions it to passengers as they get on the bus. Look, this bus isn't serving Killinarden. Great. Now I know. I have forewarning. I can get off the bus. I can make a safer way home. I have the choice now to, you know, make the decision of how I want to get home safely. It's not acceptable just to shout it out the window 2 stops before.
Okay.
So my only goal in this is to make their protocols and procedures better. Better communication.
Okay.
Is needed from the outset.
Okay, Lisa, thanks indeed. And thanks indeed, Blake, as well. I really appreciate you coming on because it is a great, great service. I must say, I don't appreciate that TFI, basically, with their budget, I think it's 2 billion, I think we give them every year, at least 1 billion for capital investment and new buses, etc., etc. They just became. It looks like they just became a sorting office for Lisa. Oh, we'll forward your email to the department. We'll forward your email to Dublin Bus. AI.
Yeah. Look, I can't speak for TFI, but I do want to say thanks to Lisa for that feedback as well. It's crucial that we get that.
Yeah,
that apology made to her. You know, we've got something to do on communication there, and I think it's just important to know as well that what we all want here is the same thing, and that's for people to be able to get on buses and travel to their destination safely, and for our drivers to do that in safety. And this incident, you know, we've had a good conversation about it. I appreciate Lisa taking the time to do that. But the really big picture on a societal level here is to stop this. You know, antisocial behaviours have doubled the incidents in the last 5 years, and that's hampering our ability to deliver those services. Look, thank you, you know, to yourself, both your listeners and Lisa for that feedback today.
And it is a great, it is our public transport, and I know it's getting better and better. It's one of the things we should have great, I think we do have great pride in it and a great allegiance to. We're the only bus passengers in the world, Lisa. As you know, we all say thank you to the driver when we're getting off. It's something that's remarked upon for me recently when I was travelling on a bus with some tourists, and they said, does everyone say thank you to the driver? They go walking. But I said, yeah, that's how we regard our public transport, and that's why. Edward is on the line. Edward, you're listening to Lisa and to Blake Boland from Dublin. Go ahead, Edward.
Yeah, Joe, this is going on a long time in Dublin, as I read in the papers. It's not new.
Nothing's been
done about it. The trouble on buses and people being intimidated and all this is going on. It's going on for a long time. I read it in the paper, Joe. It's not right. It's there. Like, why doesn't the driver have a direct line to a police car or police station?
Well, they have a direct line to control, don't they, Blake?
Control is no good. It's the cop you want. It's not control. Can't do anything. Well, he can't come out and sort it out.
No, but they're
the ones.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Well, what is the procedure? Well, let's ask Blake. He's there. In fairness, what is the procedure?
Yeah, no, I'm still here, and thanks for the question. I'm glad I hung on, and I'll try and answer that for as best I can for you before I sign off. But the driver has the ability to communicate at any given time with central control. There is an emergency button in there as well.
Okay.
And I've seen how this works. I've been in central control and I've been on board with bus drivers. So if something serious does happen, they get that there and it's all hands on deck to communicate with that driver and find out what's happening. Now, central control has that ability to get onto Angarda Síochána straight away. They've got access to some cameras. It gives them the opportunity to respond straight away. Now, it's not just on Garda Síochána as well. It's our Safer Journeys team. That's a pilot that we launched back in October 2024. Two teams initially. That's been expanded to three teams. And we've just had confirmation there in the last 2 weeks that that's going to be funded into the future as well. And these are trained security professionals that board buses around the city at different routes targeting certain areas.
Okay, but the main thing is a bus driver can immediately contact central control, who can immediately contact the Garda. What happened in Birmingham, the UK, on the bus, Edward, you witnessed?
Travelling on a bus 2 years ago, and we're between Northfield and Selly Oak, if you know it. And the bus pulled in between stops, and for about 3 minutes, and there was no hassle on the bus. Police car pulled up in front of it at about 3 minutes. The driver let him in, the spokesman driver went upstairs and took away a guy. No messing, because he is a direct line to the police car or police station. And that's the way it should be run. It's no good putting all these other things in order and all these different quangos. That's no good. You want to be straight to the place. And one door on the bus, Joe. It's no good having two doors on the bus now because it's a one-man bus. The couriers are jumping off the middle door, jumping in, jumping out, doing what they like.
Okay.
And I worked over there, and they had several trouble in the 70s. They photographed them all, right? Cameras on the bus.
Uh-huh.
And barred everyone up. There was a bus stop when they seen two guys coming up, and once they seen the bus driver, they said, no, can't travel on that bus. Walked away.
Okay.
Joe, that one there on the two doors is a very interesting one, which is actually helping us move passengers around a lot faster. And what we can do now is we can open those centre doors to let passengers off. So if they come down the stairs as well as from the lower deck and the upper deck, they can get off. And then shortly after that, our driver will be able to open the front door and let passengers filter on at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people aren't having to move away. And it just means that we can get through our stops a little bit faster, get people to where they want to be faster.
Joe McLaughlin is on the line. Joe at RT.ie. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, Jill. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Blake, and it's I will just preface what I'm going to say by I'm absolutely outraged listening to Lisa and her experience as a woman, and I feel actually very triggered by the fact that she was put off a bus and with this situation. But really, my question to Blake and to his organisation is, where is the duty of care to Lisa in that situation, and to any of us, especially women? And I am highlighting the claws of women here.
Rightly so. Yeah.
When we're walking on our own, because do men, especially like Blake is in a role there, I presume he can answer this question about you, do they realise how scared we are when we're on our own at night, and how hyper-vigilant we have to be practically all of the time, not just at night, but especially at night in a dark area?
Okay. Brief answer to that, Blake. You've covered it a number of times.
Yeah, look, my heart goes out. And to like, I have spent, I don't know how many times, 15 minutes on the phone with my wife after midnight as she's walked home to our house from a certain destination before. Mm. And although I don't experience that myself, I have females around me who go through that.
Okay, yeah.
And my heart goes out, and we don't want to be in this situation. We want this antisocial behaviour cut out. We've put the measures to do that so that everybody can get home safely. We want the exact same thing.
Okay, thanks indeed, Blake Bowen. Thanks indeed, Lisa. Joe at RT.ie, 51551 is the text number.
On 0818 715 815.
And not unrelated to what I mentioned yesterday about this new development in Meta and these new super duper glasses, which are an incredible aid for people who are visually impaired. Not unrelated indeed to what Lisa was just telling us about. I'm going to speak to Laura Bates. Laura is the author of The New Age of Sexism, How the AI Revolution is Reinventing Misogyny. And I'm very conscious, our primary schools, Laura, don't close until next Friday. And I'm conscious that there may be some very young ears listening, and some of the topics you get into of necessity are extremely dark. But then again, so I'm just saying that to parents who maybe are in confined places with young children. So some of the issues may be best for the podcast later on, but still will not dilute what we're going to talk about in any shape or form, because the metaverse was being sold to us as the next great digital frontier, a place of infinite possibility. But as I say, what happens when that imagination turns dark? And Laura says, and will be explaining to us, how it's already become a playground for virtual harassment, graphic sexual violence and deep fake abuse. Laura Bates. Laura, good afternoon and you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Laura, Meta is now one of the biggest social platforms on the internet, and they're plumbing billions into creating this whole new online world. And in the metaverse, as Mark Zuckerberg said, you'll be able to do almost anything you can imagine. Would you help one by explaining to people what is the metaverse, and in your experience, what has it become?
So the metaverse generally refers to an idea of a kind of 3D virtual world, mm-hmm. Which people are able to move around in as avatars, usually using 3D headsets.
Yeah.
Another kind of wearable technology. Meta's particular version of the metaverse is a world it is spending tens of billions of dollars creating, because it hopes that it will be a place where we are not just socializing like a kind of virtual version of social media, mm-hmm. but where we are also shopping, where we're sitting in virtual classrooms, where we're having virtual board meetings, business meetings, watching virtual events. They would like it to be a virtual world that we are all using in the future.
Wow. And it's how wide it is. It sounds like it could become very quickly a Wild West. There's so much out there.
Well, I think when we think about the metaverse, a lot of people think it's this potential thing that hasn't yet mm-hmm. been created, but it already exists. You can already access it using the company's 3D headsets, but also some elements of it from a desktop or a laptop computer. And at present, a recent study found that users are exposed to abusive behavior every 7 minutes on average. Yeah. When I entered the metaverse world using a 3D headset to research my book, mm-hmm. it took less than 2 hours before I first witnessed somebody being virtually sexually assaulted right in front of me.
Wow. And well, then take us through that if you can. You put on the headset, and where do you go first?
So you start out in a kind of virtual world where you create your avatar that you're supposed to, you know, make look mm-hmm. like you or however you want it to look. And then you start moving around various different kind of interconnected virtual worlds.
Okay.
Not all of them are directly created by Meta, although it's obviously platforming them. Some of them are created by individual developers who've created the rooms. And they're different kinds of spaces. So they might be like a virtual bar, or they might be a space where you can play a virtual game, running, mm-hmm. jumping, making virtual pizzas, or it might be a virtual aquarium where you find yourself swimming through a kind of seascape and feeding algae to fish. It's sort of anything that you can imagine, as Mark Zuckerberg has suggested.
And then how do you get to the space where you said within, what was it, an hour or 2 hours, it was sexual harassment?
Yeah, well, I mean, the sexual harassment was near constant. So people were shouting about my virtual body. They were making sexualized comments. I saw women being followed and harassed. I saw girls who were trying to sing on stage in a virtual karaoke club with adult men shouting at them and commenting on them. The 2 hours I referred to was before mm-hmm. I first saw the avatar of a woman having another avatar, a male avatar, virtually groping its bottom in front of me. And I picked up a kind of virtual marker, and I wrote in big letters on the wall, "Have you ever been assaulted in the metaverse?" And I was immediately surrounded by women saying, well, yeah, of course, everybody is, every day, it's just normal. And this has been something that reports have come in repeatedly since the metaverse was launched, from researchers, from academics, from beta testers, saying that they had experienced this. The UK police are currently investigating the alleged gang rape of a girl under the age of 16 virtually in the metaverse. So it is a space where we know that a great deal of harassment and abuse is currently happening, and we need to get to grips with that now if Meta is hoping it will be an integral part of our day-to-day lives in the future.
And but at any stage, can you just, you can't just switch off. If it is a facility, so everyone should be free and safe using it.
Yeah.
But you're saying for women, it doesn't become that. But in terms of blocking or stopping or whatever.
So what people will say is, well, why don't you just take off the headset? You know, stop making a fuss. Why are you using it if you're not comfortable there? What I would say to that is, firstly, that we cannot just systematically exclude women and girls from what will be the digital spaces of tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right now, you can step away from the metaverse because it's in its infancy and it's not integral to our day-to-day lives. But that won't be an option if you have to have a virtual board meeting there or if it's your virtual classroom tomorrow. And the other thing that's important to say is that while at present these experiences are, of course, virtual experiences of harassment, it doesn't mean that they don't still have a very unpleasant impact, but also there is technology being developed very quickly, haptic technology, where you can put on a whole body suit that has lots and lots of feedback receptors and sensors all over your body, so that when you pick something up or touch something, it will feel real. And what that will also mean, of course, unfortunately, is that if somebody else touches you, it will feel real. So it matters that we tackle this right now.
And you say, and just a separate article you've written, everybody, this is in the real world, so to speak, though I know that phrase is even interchangeable in the world we live in, digital world we live in. Everyone knows that young women are not safe. They're not safe in the street. But 86% of those aged between 18 and 20, this is in the UK, I cannot see it being much different here, they are not safe, where 86% of those aged 18 to 24 have experienced sexual harassment. 79% of young people in schools said that sexual assault was common in their friendship groups, and almost a third of 16 to 18-year-old girls reported experiencing unwanted sexual touching.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a widespread problem in the offline world that we live in. My concern is that we're transporting those norms and that normalization of everyday sexual violence into what is supposed to be a brilliant, brave new world. If we are building the future, couldn't we start with a higher bar for a place where women and marginalized groups can feel safe from the outset? It's just incredibly depressing, really.
And when you use a virtual marker to write on the virtual wall about harassment and you got an incredible response, but did some women describe their experiences in the metaverse of harassment as even more intense than real life harassment?
Yeah, so different people describe it differently. A senior police officer familiar with the case of the alleged virtual gang rape of the girl under 16 made a point of saying to the media that she had experienced psychological trauma similar to somebody who had been assaulted in the real world. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? If I'm playing a game in the metaverse and someone threw an object at my head, and I'm wearing a 3D headset and I've got this vibrating haptic technology that makes things feel like they're really in my hands, for example, when I touch them, I'm going to duck and my heart is going to race and I'm probably going to start sweating. And we all kind of accept that when we're thinking about things like video games. But for some reason, people really struggle to have empathy when women similarly experience real psychological and even physiological impact from experiences of harassment and abuse that happen in virtual worlds. But we've seen this with social media. We know it has a devastating effect.
Yeah,
we know that online abuse has a really huge effect on women and girls, and it's grinding when it's every single day and it's just part and parcel of existing in these spaces. So I think we need to look at the failings and where we have failed to prevent that from being a daily reality for women on social media and start asking the question, you know, if Meta and other platforms have utterly failed to prevent that on their existing platforms, why should we trust them with building the future?
And then is, again, one of the targets here for inculcating is young men, young boys. And I know this was probably brought to the fore in that drama series Adolescence. But you said within a few minutes of a young boy going on TikTok or signing up to TikTok, he will get messages about misogyny.
Yeah, we are living in an age of algorithmically facilitated radicalization. So if you sign up to TikTok and you tell it that you're a teenage boy, on average, it will take less than 30 minutes, studies show, before the first piece of extreme misogyny will be promoted to your feed in front of you. Teenage boys aren't inherently misogynistic. They're not going online looking for this content because they inherently are somehow programmed to hate women.
Yeah.
They are being very intensely and directly targeted and bombarded with it. And these are not narratives that are useful for teenage boys either. You know, the idea that to be a man, you have to be hard, you have to be strong, you're tough, you don't talk about your feelings, you have to be rich, you have to have flashy cars, you have to be in control of your woman who you own. None of that is a recipe for happy and healthy men either. So you know, this isn't about attacking boys. It's about saying these are things that are hurting all of us in different ways.
And do you think, Laura, because one of the points you make in a number of interviews I watched, which is a fantastic observation, that parents of today, and especially older parents, we were not raised in a digital world. The digital world arrived in our lives about 30 years ago and got bigger and bigger almost by the day. But the children are living in a digital world, and there is that chasm, that gap. So we'll be the first group of non-digital. I know we know a fair bit, but we'll be the first group of non-digital parents rearing a group of children who are all digitally educated. Yeah. And from now on, it will be different because obviously, but this is this is the gap or the jump in the generation. Do you think parents are, it seems they're not, looking at loads of ESRI survey today in Ireland here about smartphones. Do you think parents of a certain age they're not being deliberately naive, but don't fully understand the depth, the breadth and the seriousness of what can come up in their children's digital experiences?
Absolutely, and through no fault of their own, but there is that gap in experience where the daily bombardment of extreme misogyny and really quite disgusting, virulent stuff that children are seeing online, parents just don't know. And why would they know? They wouldn't have really a sense or a grasp of this. Parents are not necessarily aware of the day-to-day bombardment of endless misogyny and abuse and rape threats and unwanted sexual images that girls are experiencing in the digital world every single day. And it's not fair to expect parents to magically fix this either. You know, there's this big argument about whether parents should ban their children from smartphones, but that puts them in an impossible position. Do you prevent your child from having access to the digital world and the digital tools and skills that will be vital to their generation's future and their future careers and so on, but you keep them safe by doing it? Or do you expose them to what we know are really significant harms in order to access those tools? And the answer, of course, is that we should regulate. We should put the onus on these companies who are making obscene billions of dollars out of our children and us to make these spaces safe if they want us to continue using them. It shouldn't be on parents to have to make that decision. It should be that they can allow their children to become digital natives safely.
Okay. I want to say, if you could, please, Laura, the reaction is just a lot of people are being educated by your, and I'll give out the names of your books again just after this commercial break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm talking to Laura Bates. Laura has written a number of books, New Age of Sexism, How the AI Revolution is Reinventing Misogyny. She's a best-selling author, journalist and founder of the Everyday Sexism Project. Laura, in one interview I saw you describe, which is relevant to, I don't know whether you heard the previous item from our caller, Lisa, about that walk home in the dark. And you describe yourself and your husband both making the same journey on foot and him experiencing it completely different to you.
Yeah, we once talked about the street that we lived on, that we each walked down on our way to get the bus and to work. And I suddenly realised that when he walked down that street, he just walked down the street. He picked up a coffee on the way to the bus stop and he got on the bus. But when I walked down that street, first of all, I had to go further beyond the bus stop to get my coffee because the guys who worked in the coffee shop that was closer and more convenient used to do this really awkward thing where they would compete to get the numbers of customers and they would kind of make inappropriate comments. Mm-hmm. And then I would have to cross the street when I got to the fishmonger because the guys that worked in the fishmonger used to stand outside the front of the shop commenting on women's legs as they walked past. It made me feel really uncomfortable. And I was constantly on the lookout when I was walking down that street for a particular dark green car because once it had pulled up and kind of gone alongside me as I walked slowly and said, you always walk down this road at 12 o'clock on a Wednesday, don't you? And they had known my whereabouts and my pattern of behavior. And all of those things that for me made the process of walking down that street more complicated, more difficult, hypervigilant, as your caller described it, they were things that wouldn't even cross my husband's mind. It could, you know, through no fault of his own, they were invisible to him. And that is so true in a million other ways, I think.
And into that metaverse again, you say there are virtual brothels.
Yeah, so this is not on the metaverse. This is a real world establishment I visited when I was researching my book in Berlin. It's a so-called cyber brothel. So it's somewhere where you can go to interact with sex robots and sex dolls that use virtual reality to make them seem to come to life in front of you.
And they are becoming more and more in this world we live in. There's once again, this word real is a difficult word, but there are more sex robots, more sophisticated sex robots, and you used a haptic phrase earlier on, those movements that can happen, and they are being developed on a daily basis and expanded.
Yeah, so they're using AI technology to make them more and more realistic, and they're very deliberately blurring the boundaries to make them seem like a real woman that you can own. That's how they're marketed. She's self-warming, she's self-lubricating, she vibrates, her eyes will follow you, she will talk to you, she has a personality. You can make her look exactly how you want. You can customize her to look exactly like a real-world woman that you know by sending in a photograph, and there's nothing that woman can do about it. And it is very much about marketing this idea of ownership of what is being portrayed as a human woman, with all of the implications that has about control and about abuse. You know, some of them have been imagined by their creators with settings like a frigid setting where you can switch, basically flick a switch, and you'll be able to rape the robot while it protests and asks you to stop. You know, there is there is a huge market for this. The sex tech market is a $30 billion global industry. And bringing them to life using AI, using virtual reality, it's all about getting closer and closer to the possibility of giving men the illusion that they are real women, with everything customizable and every attribute of a real woman except for the ability to say no.
And you call deep fake pornography in the UK a national emergency in schools. 11 cases of 11 to 17 year olds, alarming stats. Our schools, and I know we can only speak about the UK, but are schools unprepared? Is a deep fake already circulating porn, deep fake porn already circulating among students? And what age group will we be talking about?
Yes, it's absolutely happening already. There have been a number of cases that have hit the headlines, but there will be many, many more cases that have not. In these cases, the children are usually in their early teens, but there have been cases with girls as young as 11 who've been targeted. Female teachers are also experiencing this. And we're talking about often young boys who are able to access technology at the click of a button, either download it on their phones or very easily find it using a search engine. And they can use these tools to take a picture that they have screen grabbed from social media or the internet of any woman or girl fully clothed, put it through the program, and within a few moments you have an extremely realistic set of images or videos that seem to show pornographic clips of that person and are highly, highly realistic. And then they inevitably circulate locally and on WhatsApp groups, and they spread to different schools. And those girls, sometimes aged as young as 11, experience all of the misogyny and the backlash and the slut-shaming that we have seen happen with the circulation of real intimate images previously. The fact that the images aren't real, when they are indistinguishable from real images, really doesn't prevent the misogyny in our society from giving them the same effect and the same impact.
Is it too late, Nora?
No, it's not too late, but it's really urgent that we do something about this now, because these things are being encoded into the systems and the foundations of a world that we are sleepwalking into, that will be transformed by AI. And if we don't tackle it now at this stage, if we don't regulate now and say, actually, if you're going to roll out a product so it affects the public, then you need to prove that it meets certain safety standards and requirements, just as we would for any other sector, for the automobile sector or for food safety standards. If we don't do that now, we're going to end up in a world where these things are inextricably built into the foundations, and it will then be really difficult to challenge them.
I'm also conscious in your... You're dealing with this every day, and you've done an incredible amount of research and made an incredible impact. What effect has it had on you, Laura? So far,
it's very distressing. Men have made deep fake pornographic images and videos of me and sent them to me. It has a really significant impact, but you know, you feel that there is a responsibility, I think, to keep fighting, because we have such a limited moment of opportunity here. And I know, because I work with children in schools every week, that there are girls. You know, if it hurts me, then imagine how it feels for that 11-year-old girl. And that's what I tell myself. And so you keep going, because you don't want a generation of girls to grow up in a world where this is considered normal.
And what prompted you, Laura, to get involved in this area? Obviously before a lot of other people.
Well, funnily enough, the story's coming full circle, because it involves a bus.
Okay.
I was on my way home one night on the bus, and a man sat down next to me and completely, suddenly and unexpectedly, put his hand between my legs and grabbed me. And I was on the phone to my mum when it happened. So I blurted out what was happening. I don't think I'd have been brave enough otherwise, but because I was talking to her, I said, "I'm on the bus. This man's just groped me." And everybody on the bus heard, and everybody looked out the window. Nobody said a word. Nobody challenged him. Wow. Nobody even made eye contact with me. And it sent the message that this was normal and that he could get away with it. And I didn't know then that the words I should have used were sexual assault. But what I did learn was that a man could sexually assault you in public, and even if you said out loud what was happening, nobody would do anything to stop him. And I wanted that not to be normal. I didn't want that to be the world that young women were growing up in. And I just thought all the time about that man and what he went on to do next. And I couldn't stop thinking about the other young women he might have sat down next to on the next bus or the next tube, and what he might have done to them, because he got the message that he could get away with it.
And you say even that week there were other incidents as well.
There were, yes. In that single week, I was also followed home by a man, pursued in the street by a man making sexualized comments, refusing to take no for an answer. And the thing that really struck me about it all at the end of the week, very sadly and depressingly, was the fact that actually if those things hadn't all happened in the same week, I might never have thought twice about it, because I was so used to it. It was just normal. And so I set out to not necessarily fix sexism overnight, but at least to disrupt the idea that it was normal, it was just the way things were, and that we shouldn't talk about it.
Well, you certainly have so far, through your work, through your writings, through your broadcasts, through your journalism. I think you've prompted a lot of people, hopefully men, young men and parents, to check themselves and be much more conscious of the dangers from a relatively young age. And it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And then the importance of the regulation of these billion-dollar industries, some of them, which, as you know, they're headquartered here in Ireland. We have a big, big role. Laura Bates, Laura, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and we will be putting this up on a special podcast, separate podcast as well, if you want to listen to it back in full. It's Laura's book is called, there's a number of books, but the one I'm talking about, The New Age of Sexism, How the AI Revolution is Reinventing Misogyny. And she's a founder of the Everyday Sexism Project. Laura Bates, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Therese Morgan. Therese, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I know what happened on back in March, Thursday the 27th of March, but you're saying it's only now that you've been able, in some small way, to get over the shock of it. What happened?
I was sitting at home and I got a knock at the door and I wasn't expecting anyone. I was working from home and I went to the door and this man said to me, he said, do you own a white cat? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was going to say to me that he'd maybe accidentally knocked her down, that he didn't mean to. Yeah. But no, it was so much worse than that. He said, three dogs attacked your cat and she's dead in my back garden. And I was like, oh my God. And to be honest, I fell apart. I have a tenant here and I wasn't able to speak. I was like, I said like, oh my God. I said, Ophelia, she's, oh my God. And I could hardly breathe. It was, and he said to me, he was afraid to go into the garden because he was afraid that they would attack him. And he said, so I brought a stick because I figured I would have to wave them away from her. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed a bag to put her body in. Mm-hmm. And I went around with him. And I, to be honest, I don't even remember walking around. I remember just looking out and seeing her whole body, like she's just opened up completely. And I walked out. I didn't even think that they might attack me. I didn't care if they did, to be honest. And I waved the stick away from them because there were two of the three still there, mm-hmm. like surrounding her. And I thought, oh my God, no. I went out and I lifted her up and I hugged her and I just burst into tears because it was so upsetting. And, I put her in the bag and I was waving them away just to keep them away from her body. And then I put her in the bag and I left and I walked back round to my house. I don't even remember the walk back. I think at some point I rang my boyfriend, but he said he couldn't get any sense out of me. So he said like he just literally jumped on his motorbike and he drove straight out here because he didn't know what really had happened because he couldn't make sense of what I was saying because I was so hysterical.
And obvious when you picked up Ophelia, was it obvious that she was dead?
Oh, God.
There was no doubt.
When I looked out from his kitchen window, and I can only imagine what it was like for him to find her, to look out and see that, would be terribly upsetting to anybody unless you were... You know, I mean, it was just, she was completely open from her whole middle was wide open. And when I lifted her up, her innards like were hanging out. Yeah. I mean, it was vicious.
Okay, the breed of the dogs. What do we know about these three dogs?
Well, I think that the ringleader was a dog that was a mixed breed dog, some kind of a pit bull kind of mixed breed. Mm-hmm. So I believe that is the dog that was probably the ringleader, really. But they operated as a pack and they surrounded her. And that's what he said when he came down. He saw they were surrounded by these three dogs.
And do we know where those dogs are now?
No, we don't. One of the dogs seems to be around, but it just seems to be it's getting loose. The one that I'm talking about, that one's is around, but
and the guard,
it seems to be being let loose.
Okay,
but it's being left loose.
Yeah, but the Gardaí have been informed.
The Gardaí have been informed, yes, and I believe there's an ongoing investigation.
Okay,
you know.
What an awful experience. How old was Ophelia?
Ophelia would have been, she was a rescue, and I rescued her as an adult cat, which a lot of people wouldn't rescue an adult cat, but we reckon she was approximately 3.5, 4 years old. And I know I sent you the pictures. She was beautiful, like everybody, when they would see her. And I used to bring her on the train with me down to my boyfriend's house, and people used to, she brought so much joy to people. Like, people would see her, even she'd be in the car, and she'd be paws up at the window, and I remember people even kind of be driving past, and or they'd look and they'd see her, and they'd go, and they like a big smile, like I said, she brought so much joy, absolute joy, to anyone who met her. You know, she really did.
We're regarded as a nation of animal lovers.
Yes, we are. We are. Yeah. I know. I know.
I see. Yeah, the fudge. She was pure white.
Pure white with pale blue eyes. You know, and it's funny, a couple of weeks after it happened, I remember being in, having a coffee somewhere, and I looked around and saw this woman, beautiful pale blue eyes, and it just, it reminded me of her, and I actually just like burst into tears. Yeah.
And would you get another cat, Therese?
Well, before she was killed, I had already got a little kitten as a little playmate for her, because she had been injured a couple of times outside. And I just got a little boy cat because I thought he'd protect her. But sadly now, he's on his own now. But I can't now let him out because I'm in fear for his life now. I'm actually looking at him here. He's in my back garden, but I literally have him tethered to the leg of a chair, leg of a sun lounger, so I can see him at all times because I couldn't leave him in the garden on his own because I don't know that dog is roaming around. And the dog, the dog has been roaming around and I believe the dog can get over walls. So I don't want to take the chance. Well, because I don't know how they got into my neighbor's garden. It had to have been over a wall. Again, as I said, I have to keep him safe. I couldn't, I'd probably lose my mind if something happened to him.
But I presume your kitten knows that Ophelia is gone.
Yeah, he does, because I brought him over to the bag and I showed him, and then he went over and he looked himself, because I didn't want him to just think that I took her away or she disappeared, because I thought that's more traumatic for him. Yeah. It was traumatic enough for me, but I just felt that, you know, it was better for him to know than just to worry or maybe think that maybe I would get rid of him. You know,
right,
because he's a rescue
as well. Yeah. Okay, you're a dear animal lover. You really are, Therese. But I can hear it in your voice, and you're upset. And again, it's a reminder about they are restricted breeds, and we all have a role in reporting them if we see them. And a lot of people are understandably very afraid of them. Therese, thanks indeed.